its banks and the euro. I don't think we're going to connect the banks directly to the euro, and rather we will be trying to deal with both problems as separately. I prepared a small presentation myself, but I can't upload it, so technology doesn't allow me to run through it. It basically is, you know, I'll take a couple of minutes to say what I wanted to say there. We're all familiar with the fact, in this room we're all familiar with the fact that Ireland is in a balance sheet recession. It's the worst case scenario possible in terms of the recessions that we know of. In my view, it is a classical balance sheet recession with all, you know, attributes. We had the financial sector collapse, asset bust. We have the structural recession. We have cyclical recession, combination of, we have the fiscal bust. I mean, you name it, anything in it is in there. So we are a basket case, which for all of us here, being economists, is great. Because it's like I described it as a chemist who walks into a lab after a massive explosion caused by unknown substances. Yes? You get to actually try to find something new in this mess. Okay? So given that we face this, I wanted to focus on a couple of things. Going forward, the Irish government has very clearly set out the stake on a banking reform. I wouldn't call it reform directly, so I'll put inverted commas around every time I mention government and reform in the same sentence. The reform is the following. It is a preservation of the status quo with a concentration of market power by existing incumbent banks, the duopoly effectively of the two-pillar banks, of which one is a very viable zombie, and this is AIB in its enlarged capacity, and another one is teetering on the edge. It can be rescued, but there is a big if, and there is a big set of questions as to what it can be rescued into. The system itself is being de-diversified. The risk is being amplified in it. We are moving from the banks which were quasi-regional and not high degree of specialization in terms of the plays, either geographically or asset classes or lending types, into the model which is becoming more and more risk concentrated. This is not going to play out well because having a small, tiny regional banks in running a small open economy on the domestic side is just yet another form of, if you want, risk concentration in the economy. The other problem we face is that the reform involves deleveraging. It involves deleveraging of the healthier assets. In other words, not through the write-downs, but through sales. In my view, that is going to run into the huge wave, tsunami wave of similar deleveraging on the healthier side of assets as well by other banks in the environment in which there is no appetite for risk. Good luck actually achieving anything meaningful out of this deleveraging plan. This plan deleveraging by the banks runs here simultaneously as the government plans to deleverage itself and to deleverage or allow deleveraging of the households, because we now know that they're not going to be conducive to helping households deleveraging themselves. So as a result of it, we have a mountain of debt which has to be deflated. The path we choose to deflate it will determine the capacity of the economy to grow, in my view, in the future. And I think we will touch upon that today as well. So I know that my speakers are saying, like, hold on a second, he's not supposed to say anything out there other than give our names.
That was exactly
but, yeah, well, I mean, I can read your minds after so many years as well. Never mind, you will get your 5 minutes each, you know, and no more. But anyway, so I'm skipping now to my last slide in which I wanted to say two things. The first thing is, whatever the strategy for recovery and growth will be or has to be, it will, in my view, involve three things. The first one is very deep structural reforms in public and private sectors to put the economy back onto some sort of the new growth capacity discovery. Entrepreneurship in new areas. Trading activities, international trading and exporting, emerging out of new areas where traditionally we have not been trading. In particular, for example, health. In other areas like education, where we haven't been trading in some parts of education at all internationally and been trading insufficiently enough internationally in other parts of education. There are other areas like basic protected professions, basic services, core services, including public services, where we will need to open up some new areas. We are not going to talk about that today. The second part of these three parts of growth and recovery strategy is regaining competitive advantages at institutional levels. Institutional reforms are lagging. We haven't even started talking about it, and yet Ireland continuously, year on year, during the crisis, slides in quality of institutions rankings globally across pretty much all of the rankings around the world. We are not noticing that. We're going to have to notice that. We have to refocus towards human and intellectual capital, away from the physical capital economy and all. We're not going to talk about that either today. But one thing that we're going to talk about today is the whole issue of the recovery can only happen if we restore functional banking system and financial system, restore a connection back between financial flows, international financial flows, and investment in the domestic economy, both internal investments and external investment from it. And I hope we're going to talk about that today and the models of how this can be achieved, how the banking will look in the future. So we'll have with us three speakers. I don't really need to introduce them, so I'll just give you their names and kind of early titles, the top headline titles. We have Professor Brian Lucey from School of Business with TCD. We have Professor Carl Willen from Economics in UCD, and Professor Frank Barry from School of Business TCD as well. So we should start probably in that exact order, so I'll yield the podium to Brian, who will say a few words. We will leave about 20 minutes, if not more, I certainly hope more, at the end for questions and answers for the whole panel. And now I'm running, I'm on the stage. Right. Okay, start my timer. What I want to do today is really not terribly complex stuff, just as well, because I wouldn't be able to do it otherwise. I want to give a brief discussion about where I see the banking market, the banking sector in Ireland going, and perhaps then some implications from that and some of the recent research that's floating around there. I will caveat all of this by saying, of course, that you know, economics and finance, like any social science, where you have one research paper that says X, you'll have another research paper that says not X. But I've tried to give a flavour of the preponderance, as I've seen it, of research recently in certain areas. And I'm calling it back to the future, primarily because I wanted to have a nifty slide with flux capacitors and a DeLorean, but because I think we are actually going in the future back to where we were in the 1980s. Constantine alluded to it, but we are in fact, I think, looking at the re-emergence of a banking duopoly in Ireland. Not a real duopoly in the sense of only two providers, but something very similar to that. Any of us who remember the 1970s or early 80s will remember you had a choice of being turned down for your loan by the Bank of Ireland or the Bank or AIB. If you were really lucky and you were in a metropolitan area of more than 10,000 people, you could also be turned down by National Irish Bank, sometimes, or Ulster Bank, depending on whether you were north or south of a line between Meath and Galway. We're looking at a deliberate policy of two pillar banks. The last time I thought about pillars, it was, Lot's wife and pillars of salt after a Holocaust, so maybe that's not entirely inappropriate. But these two pillar banks are being a deliberate creation of government policy. And in fact, today we see that AIB are saying, we've had enough from the banking buffet, please. We'd rather not actually try and digest permanent TSB. Go find somebody else for it. And I'm going to suggest that maybe we need to think this through again. There's no doubt that with the creation of these pillar banks, with the creation of a consolidated duopoly banking market, we're going to end up with significant job losses. We know that these job losses are there. They're going to be released sooner or later. We know that there's a huge demand, even in this depressed economy, SMEs and new mortgages. Central bank figures suggest that, we might be looking at maybe 15 billion in the next 3 or 4 years. And that's really just a ticking over. All of that's going to happen in an environment where the banks are having to deleverage and to bring their loan-to-deposit ratio down to 125%. So they're still facing into very rough waters, I suppose. I'm calling this the pure loan-to-deposit ratio. You can measure loan-to-deposit ratios in any number of ways, but this is a very simple level, which is the total amount of resident and non-resident deposits, the total amount of resident and non-resident loans. So it tries to take out
perhaps artificially in some senses, the interbank activities, actual deposits by real people and corporations, actual loans to real people and corporations. And we'll see that in that context, the banks still have a fairly significant way to go in terms of deleveraging. And if you're facing into a deleveraging situation and your deposit base is under pressure, you're going to have to more quickly sell off or write down loans. Now, Irish banks do have some non-Irish loans. They have non-Irish loan books, so they can do that. But there is going to be deleveraging of core resident business and mortgage loans. If we look at the covered banks, the six banks that were given the guarantee, and we look at their resident private sector loans and deposits, look at the share of the market which they have in that, we can see that in fact, certainly in the last couple of years, with significant volatility, but there is a bit of a trend for, certainly until the leveraging kicked in, for the covered banks to gain market share. And certainly their deposits, after taking a big hit back in the immediate epicenter of the crisis in 2008, or the first epicenter, have picked up a little bit recently, but not back to where they were. It's not clear, but there's, you could argue that the covered banks are beginning to make back up some of the ground in deposits. They're not going back to where they were, and where their loans are going, it's not quite clear. But they've got a big share. This is the six banks, and given that, the bank that dare not speak its name has a large proportion of the activity still, this excludes NAMA, you can see that the pillar banks really are an effective duopoly. 70-75%, I think, is pretty close to that. Let's think back. There were many pictures I could have taken. Let's think back to why we did, why was done unto us that which was done unto us in 2008. And the argument was very clear. Anglo is not going to open in the following day. We don't want to have a disorderly collapse. We have to do something. Here is a thing. We must therefore do it. But there was a good reason to do something. What was done was perhaps not the optimal, and Merrill Lynch had a set of proposals which were, more or less ignored. But we ended up where we ended up for reasons that passeth all understanding. If you think about it, an ongoing guarantee, and I use ongoing deliberately there, you can think of that in many ways like being a subsidy to those that get it. You'll be familiar, of course, with the argument that, look, the guarantee per se was not a bad thing. It was the fact that the guarantee was continued indefinitely across a whole pile of areas and forever and ever, amen, that has caused the problem. Even allowing for that, those that are guaranteed are in some ways protected, explicitly protected. I mean, bad and all, as their funding position is, the Irish banks are much better off hiding behind the tattered skirts of Kathleen Ni-Houlihan's fiscal rectitude than they would be out there trying to get money on their own. There's no doubt about that. Those that don't have the guarantee face a disadvantage. They've got a choice. They can either exit the market. We've seen that in the Irish banking context. They can accept a secular drag on their profits because they're not able to compete on a level playing field. They're disadvantaged. They're not subsidized, in effect. Or the dangerous thing would be they might actually decide to chase more return, and that return will come through chasing more risk. So you might find that one of the consequences is of a guarantee that you crystallize the activities of one sector and you perhaps force risk onto the other sector if it wishes to chase the profits and to try and engage in the normal business imperative. And there is some recent research out there on what I'm calling risk embedding. There's a bunch of papers in the last 3, 4, 5 years. References are available on the slides at the end, and I'll put these slides up on my blog immediately after this session, so you can take them there and contact me if you want the actual papers. I'll give them to you. But some very interesting words which I think will ring true with us here. The market share of the insured, basically covered, as that increases, it significantly increases banks' risk-taking. In other words, the more of the market that you insure or cover, the greater the embedding of risk, and that is substantial. This does not necessarily arise, this argument runs, from public ownership per se, or sorry, from protected banks per se, except for banks with outright public ownership. Well, we've at least one bank that isn't outright publicly owned, so I guess we're okay there. As long as markets continue to expect banks to be bailed out in the case of difficulties, these competitive distortions may persist. It's actually obvious enough when you think of it. You've got one sector which is protected, which can get on and do what it wants. The other sector is out there trying to fight for its corner or has to exit. Neither of these are good outcomes. And in fact, some evidence is that the protected sector, its risk-taking doesn't increase, may even increase. It's a very recent paper, initially from September last year, now updated with new data just literally a couple of days ago, which suggests that, and okay, it's looking at the TARP, it's looking at the US situation, it's not necessarily directly projectable into the Irish environment. But it's, if true, or if it were to be carried through, would be somewhat worrying that within Basel asset classes, in other words, within a bucket of mortgages, or a bucket of commercial loans, or a bucket of sovereign debt, or a bucket of any other activity that a bank could do, that there's evidence from very detailed bank statement analysis that banks actually shift within those classes towards the riskier end. Now, we're aware that a AAA mortgage is not necessarily the same as another AAA mortgage. We're aware that a sovereign risk weighted at zero under Basel II is not necessarily the same as another sovereign. So again, this makes sense and is congruent with that which we've seen in the previous research. Bailed out banks appear safer according to capitalization ratios. How many times have we heard recently Irish banks are the best capitalized in the world? Well, that's true on the ratios that we measure, but that does not necessarily imply if the Irish banks were to be following the US situation, and I'm not saying they do, so it would be worth an investigation. I think the data, certainly the central bank would have the data. I think it would be difficult to do outside the central bank. You'd need to have access to more detailed, you know, monthly and quarterly reports, but it can be replicated, and I think it would be worthwhile investigating whether this phenomena, and if it is taking place, is quite worrying, would be quite worrying. Okay, well, maybe then let's look at competition. Competition per se is not a bad thing. In fact, there's some evidence that more competitive banking systems are less prone to systemic crises, and in fact, when they do enter into a crisis situation, are more robust, and that it takes longer for that system to fall over. The implication of that is that if it is the case, you should have promotion of pro-competition policies. This is not, I'm not saying a free-for-all, I'm not suggesting that we allow a thousand flowers bloom, but that more competitive systems will perhaps give a better outcome than less competitive systems for a given level of size, structure, regulation, etc. Banking crises are persistent. Very recent research from the Bank of Poland suggests that, if you look at the diagonals here, output and credit, are these in what's called a calm, trundling along at or above normal growth rates, or a crisis below average growth rates? Well, if you're in a calm situation, you're 87% probability that if you're in a calm situation in one period, you'll be in a calm situation the next period. In other words, even in a calm period, there's a 13% chance that you'll move from okay to a crisis of some sort, either in credit or in output. But here we are, down here, in the crisis. And there's only a 50-50 chance from 103 banking crises estimated with 8 or 9 years pre and post each crisis, a lot of fancy econometrics. Once you're in this crisis of credit and crisis of output, there's only a 50% likelihood that the next period you will be out of it. So these crises are persistent and they're sticky, and we're in one. So on to some suggestions, and I'll run through these as we go through it. I think we need more cooperative banks. I think we need new banks, whether they're privately owned, foreign owned. We certainly need better regulated banks. I think we may need to need more focused banks. I think banks that are focused on mortgages, banks that are focused on activities such as commercial, banks that are focused on investment, within the context of more and more competitive and better regulated, and also smaller, and I'm picking this number completely out of the air, e.g. a 30% cap, that as you are approaching 30% of gross national product, which is a relevant metric in the Irish context, you really need to think about whether this bank is becoming too large, so that if there were a problem, it would begin to cause a problem, even if you weren't going to bail it out. Maybe the optimal level is 20, maybe it's 40. There are models you could think of. It's just an idea. We need to think about whether or not we need to wind down or break up those existing banks that have had this moral hazard, risk-taking embeddedness placed upon them. That's a much longer, it's a whole conference in that. But there are clear implications from the research that embedding moral hazard is not good and is persistent. All right, Lucy, didn't competition ruin us? Sure, weren't we fine until all these dirty foreigners came along and started giving us money and putting up banks in high streets and giving fellas loans and making people take credit? And, you know, we all remember that. You know, you'd be there forced. You'd be there beside a bank. They'd be dragging you in looking to give you money, making you take out money. Before that, it was fine. I don't think so. The evidence doesn't seem to suggest that. The evidence, you know, evidence, but there's relatively little evidence of competitive pressure as evidenced by the bank's own responses to surveys within the boom. Now, the caveat is that survey evidence is only as good as survey evidence. No bank is going to say, yes, we are a follower, not a leader. But we can look at persistency and trends. If we look at the share of the five largest credit institutions in Ireland, in fact, that rose slowly, but rose over the period of the bubble. If we look at the Herfindahl Index, which is a standard measure of competitiveness, that indicated a decrease in competitive pressure within the Irish banking market. There's no significant evidence from those structural indicators that there was a major emergent problem with competitiveness at the very highest level. Every quarter, the banks fill in a survey. Across Europe, they fill in a survey. It's a standard survey, a Eurobarometer type analysis. And among the questions that are asked are, looking back at the last quarter, which of the following 8 or 10 issues caused, were influential, and if so, into what extent, in changing your credit standards? Basically, were these causing your conditions and standards to loosen or to tighten? And I've looked here at competition in home loans, competition in enterprise loans, which would include developers, competition in consumer loans. Three is unchanged. In effect, up until about 2007, unless they were telling lies consistently, persistently, and internally consistently, there's no evidence from those that the banks were admitting to seeing competitive pressure. This is not the case necessarily in other European countries. You're suggesting cooperative banks, but sure, we know they're desperately inefficient at all things. Why would we want those? That conception is not necessarily true, in fact. You've got to be careful. When economists talk about things, they tend to use words that sound like words normal people will use. and will have specialized technical meaning, because that's the nature of any profession. They will use jargon. They will use words that are technically, even that word, loaded. There are many different kinds of efficiencies, efficiency measures you could apply to banks. But we have some evidence that within the US, cooperative banks, mutual banks, versus what you might call regular shareholder type banks, there doesn't seem to be major differences in how in the measured efficiency of these banks. And where there is differences, it tends to be because of what's called the output mix, that cooperative and mutual banks tend to have a different kind of output mix to commercial banks. But allowing for that, there's not necessarily the case that one is more inherently efficient than the other. There is some evidence that Irish credit unions are quite inefficient as measured in these technical senses. But what we don't have, and Donal MacKillop has done vast amounts of work on the credit union movement worldwide, what we don't have is we don't have a comparative analysis of the efficiency of Irish banks under a set of measures versus Irish credit unions, because you can't compare two papers even if they're doing the same thing. Partly that's because the data for Irish banks are not easy to get, partly because the data are sparse anyway. There's also some evidence that how bond rating agencies and how creditors look at cooperative and commercial banks are not dissimilar. So there's no strong evidence, one way or the other, that cooperative banks or mutual banks are any worse or any better at a technical level of doing their job of banking. They're not necessarily too small. In the top 40 banks in the world, there are 3 cooperative or mutual banks. In countries where cooperative banks are more prevalent, they account for up to 40% of SME lending. And, there's a missing word there. Co-op banks account for about 20% of the total amount of deposits in the system. There are problems with the CAIAs. There are problems with the SNL. I know Constantine is waving at me, but as he stood up and took all our time, we'll just keep going. I'm nearly finished. I'm nearly done. Those are problems that are perhaps sui generis to the SNLs and to the CAIAs. They're a problem of bad regulation. My final point is that I'm suggesting we might want to look to the east. One more slide after this. 2. If you're thinking about what I'm suggesting there, one of the implications might be specialised mortgage banks. Now that, of course, sounds very similar to what we used to call building societies. But specialised mortgage banks exist in other European countries. Denmark has a very interesting banking system. And if we look at the share price performance of Danish banks, yeah, of course they've taken a hit, but not nearly as bad as the absolute wipeout of wealth in the Irish banking system. Danish mortgages work on a very, very conservative approach. Mortgage banks are very conservative. They do a lot of covered bond issuance. They have a balance principle, which means they can't really get too far out of whack on the assets and liabilities side. They've got a good land registry, speedy resolution, very conservative loan to valuation. 80% is unusual and is the upper limit. They're very well regulated, strict laws, and of course they're full of very law-abiding Nordic types, which is, you know, helpful. Interestingly, the Danish market is more concentrated than the Irish market, but that concentration is stable. Now, my suggestion, therefore, to finish, is that we need to rethink where the Irish banking market is going. We're heading back to a duopoly without even the benefit of having this credit, the building societies we used to have. There are lots of evidence out there that suggests that more competition, smaller, more focused banking might be a better way forward. So in the spirit of what Liam and Stephen and Colm Harmon asked, I'm throwing these out as ideas for policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian, I think there's some good thoughts there for questions down the road as well. I know I have some, so we can get to that at the end. And I would like to invite Carl Willen, Professor Willen from UCD, to give his talk about the same topic as well. Thanks, Carl.
Okay. I'm going to talk about I only got 20 minutes. So I'm going to talk about a very specific aspect of what's going on with the Irish banking system and with the Irish sovereign debt problem. And it's an issue that can bamboozle pretty much anybody if you start getting lost in it. What I'm going to try to do is explain what's going on with the IBRC and its ELA debts and the promissory notes and so on in 20 minutes, so that at the end of the 20 minutes, maybe some of the mist is cleared a little bit and people have a slightly better idea what it is that's going on. Why is this an important topic? Well, I think one reason is that it's the man in the street. I mean, pretty much everybody in Ireland now knows that the Irish state is carrying a very large debt burden due to the decisions that were taken to bail out the banks, and specifically to do with the decisions to bail out Anglo-Irish Bank and Irish Nationwide. But I think that there's a lot of confusion about exactly what form this debt burden takes and what we could do about it. So I'm going to go through three things. I'm going to talk about this beast now called the IBRC and what its balance sheet roughly looks like, what assets it has and who it owes money to. Then I'm going to talk about something called exceptional liquidity assistance. You may or may not have heard of it. And then I'm going to talk about promissory notes, which you probably have heard about, and talk about this idea that's in the mix of a potential restructuring of promissory notes. There's a lot of numbers in the slides. It's all going to be made available publicly on various websites. I'm happy to put it on my personal website. I'm sure it'll go on there, irisheconomy.ie, and so on. So I'm not going to focus so much on the numbers. People can go back and study these if they want. So I'm going to go very quickly through the numbers and just make the points that I want to make. This is Anglo's balance sheet just on the eve of the crisis, the end 2007. And what we can say is that the bank had gotten very big, about 93 billion euros. So it was heading for, you know, over 50% of Irish GDP. And then it had a lot of debt funding. In addition to the 58 billion in deposits, which themselves were sort of pretty flighty large corporate deposits, there were 23 billion in debt securities. So once upon a time, there were a lot of Anglo bondholders, and Anglo didn't owe any money to the central bank. By the end 2010, the balance sheet's very different. Most of the deposits have gone. Most of the debt securities have been paid off. The bank has shrunk in size, but it hasn't shrunk enough to pay off. This is about 60 billion or 70 billion or something in funds that have gone out the door. In fact, I think more than about 80 billion. So how has it managed to pay everybody off? How did the bondholders get paid off? How did the big corporate depositors get paid off? The answer is they got the money from central banks. Specifically, by the end of 2010, they owed about 17 billion to the ECB, and they owed 28 billion in something called exceptional liquidity assistance to the Central Bank of Ireland. I'll talk more about what that is. By the second half of last year, though, the last official report we have on Anglo, we know that the structure of those two changed quite a bit. It had very little debts owed left to the ECB, and nearly all of its central banking debts were 38 billion were owed in this exceptional liquidity assistance. Its terrible twin, Irish Nationwide, in the same way, was funding itself with a lot of debt securities just on the eve of the crisis, 6.7 billion. By end 2010, those guys have all been paid off. So this is my guess as to the liability structure of or the structure of the Irish Bank Resolution Corporation's balance sheet as of about the middle of last year. They owed 58 billion to people, and of that, basically almost a negligible amount of deposits. Pretty small amount of debt securities, a little bit to the ECB. The big debt that these guys owe is 42 billion in the so-called ELA that they owe the Irish Central Bank. If we look on the asset side, what assets do they have? They have some loans. These are the loans that didn't go to NAMA. They've got some other stuff. If you take that stuff together, that's more than enough to cover all the other people that they owe money to, the deposits, the debt securities, debts to the ECB. Right? So the reason they have this other asset that we'll talk about, the promissory note, the only reason they need that is because they owe $42 billion to the central bank. Okay? So one thing to take away from this immediately is if we cancel the promissory note tomorrow, there would be no private bondholder that would lose out. The ECB would get paid back in full. This is a purely intra-official arrangement. That balance sheet, that's the best I can do based on available information, but that's now already out of date because the debt securities of $6.3 billion as of the middle of last year, well, since then we've gone and paid off various amounts. Plus, it's worth noting that only $2.9 billion of that $6.3 was unguaranteed. So the rest of it was subject to the same guarantee program that AIB and Bank of Ireland have issued a lot of debt under, and there are questions as to whether or not you want to mess with that guarantee. So if we're talking about the unguaranteed, unsecured bondholders that everybody hears about in Vincent Brown every night, then there were only $3 billion of them left in the middle of last year. We paid off $1 billion in October 2011 and €1.25 billion 2 days ago. There is less than $1 billion left of them. And yet we know that we're going to be spending $3.1 billion a year to fund this promissory note structure. So I think it's time that people understood the magnitudes here and understood that that complaining about bondholders been taking off is largely a past tense event. Okay, so what is this ELA? ELA stands for Exceptional Liquidity Assistance, and it's provided by the central bank. And the legal basis for this comes from the Central Bank Act of 1942, which allows the central bank to lend to organizations that are in financial trouble if them going under will cause financial stability problems. It's completely separate from the usual euro system loans that are part of the sort of normal monetary operations. And for instance, that means that the central bank can accept collateral, you know, that supposedly covers it in case of losses, that is completely unacceptable in a normal ECB driven operations. But the flip side of that is that that means that all the risk is supposed to fall on the Central Bank of Ireland. It's not shared with the rest of the euro system, and in order to do this, we had to write a letter to the ECB that said that we would make sure that this exceptional liquidity assistance was paid back. We didn't promise a time schedule. Where does this come from? There's some confusion about this in all the media treatment that I've seen in the last week or two. A lot of people seem to think that this money that came from the Irish Central Bank borrowing it from the ECB. That's not true. The exceptional liquidity assistance money effectively is conjured up out of thin air. This is classic textbook money creation. Central banks can do it. And in fact, the ECB don't issue money at all. The ECB is a centralized body in Frankfurt. All money issuance in the euro area is done by the national central banks. How did this help out IBRC? The money is created out of nowhere, and they stick it in the reserve account that IBRC holds with the central bank, and then the IBRC was able to write lots of checks on that and pay off deposit holders, depositors and bondholders. The central bank charges interest on these loans. It's supposedly a super top secret interest rate, although it somewhat gives the game away that the central bank do actually publish how much income they earn in interest, and you also know the size of the ELA, so it's sort of rough calculation by one by the other. Maybe it shouldn't be so super secret. They should just come out and say, but my calculations, it's probably, the formula is probably something like the ECB refinancing rate plus 150 basis points. And does that mean is that all pure profit? They conjured it up out of nowhere and they're taking in interest? Well, sort of yes and no. I mean, it's no in the sense that let's say when the IBRC got its reserve balances credited, they get paid interest on that. When money went from the IBRC to pay off bondholders in Germany and money was moved out of the country, that increases the central bank's somewhat mysterious, what's known as the Target 2 liability. If I get to come back someday and talk for 20 minutes about Target 2, then we'll have real fun. But you do pay an interest rate on that, so you could reduce that liability if the money was paid back. So maybe it's not completely costless or not a completely pure profit for the Central Bank of Ireland. Anyway, that's what the operation is. Where does that show up in the central bank's accounts? It shows up in what's called the central bank balance sheet. I'm not sure the central bank balance sheet's a good good name for this, but we know that central banks have lots of assets. And how do they acquire these assets? They acquire these assets by printing off money, right? And that's a power that they have to do that the rest of us, unfortunately, don't have. Okay, and every year they print a thing that called a balance sheet that shows all the assets they'd acquired. Well, because people who put together balance sheets like to call the other side of the balance sheet from the assets liabilities, then there is an entry on the other side, and basically all the money that they created to go acquire these assets gets called a liability. But you know, from the point of view of a central bank, liability is effectively fictional, right? They've created all this money. But they can print money, so there's no problem with this. Central banks don't go bust. Now, if you go and keep marking these assets to market, and they go up or down, then there may be some gap between the total value of the assets and the total value of these quote unquote liabilities, and that item is central bank is called the capital of the central bank. But you know, if that became negative, the value of the assets went below. The value of the liabilities, it's not like a private bank, right? It's, people say, oh, the central bank becomes insolvent. It doesn't really mean anything, right? What are you going to do about it? Are you going to stop using their money? Not, you know, you might if it's Zimbabwe, but if it's the euro, no, you're not. What does that balance sheet look like? In February 2011, it looked like this. Why am I showing February 2011? Well, I'm going to show you what happens to the central bank's balance sheet when people pay back ELA debts. Because right? We know Anglo has all this, IBRC has all these ELA debts. We'd like to know what happens. They're getting paid back to the Central Bank of Ireland. Maybe the good people of the Irish Central Bank are going and investing them for us and buying gold or something like that. And we'll all get it back eventually, and it's all just a big wheeze. Unfortunately, that sounds too good to be true. That's because it is. Here's the Central Bank balance sheet as of February 2011, and what we see is this is the other ELA is hidden in this other assets. So it's other stuff. Don't tell anybody, but 70 billion, and most of it's ELA. But AIB, Bank of Ireland, other banks have paid back quite a bit of ELA. So by December 2011, that was down to 44. Now, there's our entry for securities, gold, other claims, 21. Did it change much? The answer is no, it didn't change much. Right? What happened? Central bank liabilities, the amount of money created, went down from 208 billion to 176. Effectively, what happens is the money comes inside the central bank, and just as easy as they can create money, they can destroy it. Okay? So when the ELA gets paid back to the central bank, effectively, it just gets taken out of commission, right? And it doesn't get put anywhere. There's no side benefit to us from repaying the ELA, which raises the very obvious question. Why in God's name do we not just write off the thing? Patrick Honohan seems like such a nice man. Surely he could just write the government and say, listen, it's all right, fellas, no need to pay it, right? And, you know, you could say, no, we can't do that because the central bank will be insolvent. And there are various issues to do with that you're not supposed to be in, that's not supposed to happen in the euro area, but on its own it's not a sort of, you know, dun, dun, dun. It's not, on its own, nothing happens, something particularly bad happens. So closer to correct is, yeah, that's a great idea, right? Who cares about the central bank being insolvent? Who cares about the central bank balance sheet? The problem is, let's think about what we've done if we got away with that. What we would have done is we would have gone and printed off a load of money, and we would have given it to a deeply insolvent bank, which would have then gone and paid off a load of bondholders. Now, from our point of view, writing off all that and suddenly the bondholder debt doesn't have to be paid back, it sounds great. But if you're a German, that sounds pretty iffy, right? I mean, if you're a German and you start thinking about this and you say, I think this is an abuse of the power to print euros. You printed, that's not just your currency, that's our currency too. And you just printed off a load of it, you know, like snuff at a funeral, whatever. And it's also, look, it may be 31 billion might be small, relative to the total euro area money stock. But this is poor precedent. If we let you guys do it, everybody has bad banks. Even the Germans have bad banks. Right? If everybody could just do this trick, print off a lot of money, give it to the bankrupt banks, pay off the creditors, and then say, forget about it, there'll be loads and loads of money getting printed all over the euro area. And the one thing, the one piece of macroeconomics that has firmly implanted itself on the German public's brain is that if you print lots of money, you get inflation, okay? And to a first approximation, they're right, okay? So this plan might seem very attractive to us, but it's not that attractive to people who want to have low inflation. Okay? So the ECB thought of this kind of thing, right? And when we joined the euro system, we had to sign up to something called Article 14.4 of the ECB statute, which says, basically, anything we want to do that's outside the normal framework, a two-thirds vote of the Governing Council can stop it if they deem it to be interfering with the objectives and tasks of the euro system. What that means is, if we came up with this great plan that I'll pay the ELA back, the ECB can say no. Right? And that's where we are right now. Okay, so there's lots of conversations about technical discussions among technical people who write technical notes about technical issues. This issue is as simple as the reason we have to pay this money back is because the ECB insists on that we have to pay it back. So how are they going to pay it back? How they're going to pay it back is we've given them this promissory note. There's a huge amount of discussion about restructuring the promissory note. It's very important to understand that if we decide to put less money in to the IBRC, but the IBRC still has to pay back all its ELA debts, then we're not getting anywhere. Okay? The promissory note is a function of the fact that the IBRC has all these ELA debts, and the ECB is insisting on it being paid back. This schedule here that a lot of people have now heard about, the promissory note payments, $3.1 billion a year, implicitly, you know, you mightn't have heard of it, this must have been agreed with the ECB Governing Council, that this is okay. The way we're running our ELA program and using this vehicle to pay it back, that must be okay. That is the purpose of the promissory note, is to pay back the ELA very, very slowly over long periods of time. So a very simple graph of what's going on with the promissory notes is the promissory notes provides, the Irish government provides the promissory notes to the IBRC. The IBRC owes ELA debts, the Central Bank of Ireland. They take in the repayment of the ELA and they reduce the stock of money that's outstanding. Effectively, they burn it. Most of the financial journalists that have written about this issue have highlighted that the key issue is the interest rate on the promissory notes. It's an extremely complicated issue. It's understandable that they make a mistake, but basically they're wrong. The promissory notes were modeled after Irish government bonds. Irish government bonds, when they were issued, had a high interest rate. Therefore, the promissory notes have a high interest rate. However, suppose the interest rate on the notes was 50%, right? Then we'd be sticking huge amounts of money inside the IBRC. Well, as long as the IBRC is just paying back the ELA at this 2.5% rate, that just means that we have this publicly owned bank that's accumulating all these profits every year. And eventually they can give it back to us. The interest rate on the promissory notes is a red herring. If, and I wouldn't count this out, if Michael Noonan comes back someday from Brussels and says, victory, I have negotiated the interest rate down on the promissory notes, then you'll know that he failed to get anything useful done. Okay? One small issue to do with the interest rate in the promissory notes is there is a deviation between what I'd call reality and what I'd call Eurostat's accounting of the promissory note. The actual payments on the note are $3.1 billion a year until 2023, and then there's smaller amounts happen later. Eurostat, in their wisdom, and I'm sure there's a statistician here that can explain this to me, decided that instead they would book $31 billion, all $31 billion value of the notes, on our national debt in 2010. That's why we had a world record deficit that year. And then all the interest on the notes, which they basically is everything in addition to $31 billion that gets paid. But if you look at the schedule just pays in 3.1, 3.1, and then smaller amounts. It's not clear what's interest, what's principal. They calculated the interest on it by looking at the total sum, the $48 billion. But when it's interest, when it's principal, who decides that? It turns out some guy at Eurostat decides that. Right? So there's a pretty arbitrary schedule for interest. 0.6, 2012, zero. We are on an interest rate holiday from the promissory note this year. If you didn't know we were all on holiday, now you know. Okay? Is that going to make us feel better? Well, when March 31st comes along and we pay $3.1 billion, you're not going to be too happy about the holiday, right? But the holiday, like all holidays, they come to an end. And our holiday ends in 2014, and then it's $1.8 billion. That's counted as interest. And that gets counted on the deficit. Now, again, we're still paying $3.1 billion a year. It doesn't matter. But for the deficit that the Eurostat people count, that will go up by 1.8 billion. And if we are targeting the general government deficit still that year, then we'd need 1.8 billion in spending cuts and tax adjustments just to keep stay still. So in substance, the interest rate doesn't matter, but there is this annoying technical issue. I would suggest if we've taken a holiday once that we can take it again, and we should pursue that when the time comes. Okay. That is pretty much all I have to say. I want to finish with a concrete proposal then. Okay. Firstly, I think the government should be clearer in its discussions with the Irish public about what exactly the issue is. That the issue is this bank doesn't need another cent apart from the money that it has to pay back the Irish Central Bank. And the reason it has to pay back that 3.1 billion a year according to this schedule is because the ECB insists. It's not really that complicated a story, right? You can handle that. So the concrete proposal that we should have is to leave the IBRC with its loans that it has and with resources that it has without the promissory note to pay off as much as it can, to pay off everybody else, the bondholders, the ECB, to pay off as much of the ELA as it can, and to leave the promissory notes payments to start at some point when the country has recovered from its crisis, some sort of quantitative criteria that says, if unemployment is low or if the economy has grown cumulatively, whatever, then we can start repaying this 31 billion, and we'll do so, I would propose, very, very slowly over time. And then we put that for consideration to the ECB Governing Council, and are explicit about this. The government should be explicit that its goal right now is to not pay 3.1 billion on March 31st. The only reason I can see for not coming out every day and saying, we are working on not paying 3.1 billion on March 31st, is fear of failure. Because if they don't get that and we pay 3.1 billion on March 31st, there'll be no way to spin that. Okay? I suspect that that's why you're not being, in a sense, being told the truth. And instead being told it's all very technical and go away and, you know, trust Michael Noonan. Okay? So that's my proposal. I suspect we're behind time, and maybe we'll have Frank talk about the euro and then we can take all sorts of questions afterwards.
Perfect.
Okay?
Issues that I'm going to talk about here are quite simple relative to the previous two presentations, but they're controversial, as you'll see, in that some people, part of the institutional system, deny, even at that stage, that there are any design flaws in the way the euro was constructed. These are taken from a speech that Trichet, then president of the ECB, gave in Dublin. So denying that there are any design flaws. Now, the design flaws that I'm going to talk about here were all recognised before the European, before the euro came into being, but there was a general air of denial. The project was pushed forward on the basis of a political agenda. And, you know, I believe that sooner or later these design flaws were going to appear, but once the project was underway, they would be rectified when the crisis exploded. It was quite clear that a crisis was going to explode sooner or later. Trichet in this speech said, as long as the fiscal constraints represented by the Stability and Growth Pact are respected, then the euro will work fine. Now, the one bit of economic analysis that you need to retain in your mind here is that an exchange rate is a valuable instrument of economic policy for a country when that country is hit by a shock that is specific to that country. If the entire eurozone is hit by a common shock, then the exchange rate is not going to be of value to any individual country within that system. It might give it a quick competitiveness gain, but that competitiveness gain, that'll be a beggar thy neighbour policy, and that competitiveness gain would be inflated away pretty rapidly as wages catch up to the higher inflation. So the exchange rate is only a valuable instrument of economic policy over the medium to long term when it's used in response to a shock that hits a single country or a small number of countries within the system. The assumption behind what Trichet said in this speech is that country-specific shocks within the Eurozone are largely the result of divergent fiscal policies. And hence all this discussion of, you know, the current fiscal compact, it really is a fetish based on the notion that if countries adhere to tight fiscal constraints, then there will be no country-specific shocks that we need to worry about. But the optimal currency area literature that emerged in the 1960s recognized that countries differ from each other, or think of states in the US Union, differ from each other in terms of their production structure and their trade structure, and that makes them vulnerable to state-specific, or in the European case, country-specific, or the general term we use is asymmetric shocks. And I can give you a couple of examples of that in a moment, but Barry Eichengreen is probably the world's leading economic historian of international monetary relations. He did a lot of work with co-authors in the mid-1990s, before the euro came into being, analysing the extent to which countries of the EU-12 economies, as they were then, before you know the expansion to include Finland and Sweden and Austria, and then later on, of course, the countries of Central and Eastern Europe. So before they were part of the euro. So he analysed the 12 countries of the EU that existed at that time, analysed the extent to which the structure of their production and trade structures meant that they were good candidates for an optimal currency area. And he identified a group of peripheral countries that included the UK, but Ireland as well, but also the other countries that we think of now as the EU periphery, that were vulnerable to non-policy-induced country-specific shocks. So in other words, even if you had monetary policy harmonized, as of course we do in the Eurozone, even if you had fiscal policy harmonized, this particular group of countries would remain vulnerable to country-specific shocks. An easy way of thinking about that is that their business cycles are out of sync with the business cycle of the Eurozone core, which is Germany, France, Belgium, Netherlands, and so on. That's an easy way to think about it. It's easy to understand in Ireland's case now, given the Eurozone system that exists, why Ireland is particularly vulnerable to asymmetric shocks, that is, shocks that are going to hit Ireland and that are not going to be to hit in the same way the generality of the Eurozone countries. Ireland remains, by nature of its geography, an Atlantic economy. We're highly dependent, as everybody will know, on foreign direct investment from the US. That means the state of the US economy is of importance to us, the state of corporate finances of the big multinationals, which are mostly American, is important in terms of their investment decisions. And the UK remains a very important export destination for labour-intensive products of indigenous industry, as well, of course, as UK industry is the chief competitor for these products. The UK is not so important for the multinationals that are here, but, of course, the multinationals are not nearly as labour-intensive as indigenous industry. So Ireland remains vulnerable to non-policy-induced asymmetric shocks, for which an exchange rate would be a valuable instrument. Now, we've given up the exchange rate, but there are substitutes for the exchange rate as an instrument that can be used to adjust for these kinds of shocks. So policy, fiscal policy harmonisation, as you know, entailed in the Stability and Growth Pact, as entailed, of course, in the new fiscal compact that's proposed, will largely remove policy-induced asymmetric shocks because everybody will basically have the same fiscal policy, you know, by and large, speaking somewhat loosely. But it won't, of course, remove the potential for other asymmetric shocks to hit Ireland and the other peripheral Eurozone countries. So a couple of examples of asymmetric Irish shocks. You remember when Ireland was in the exchange rate mechanism and sterling devalued, that hit us, of course, with a huge competitiveness shock because of the importance of the UK to us as an export destination. and because of the importance of British industry as a competitor to Irish industry. So these were big competitiveness shocks that we were hit with in 1986, in the run-up to 86, and in the run-up to 1993. Now, Irish conditions were worsened at that time, of course, because we weren't part of the Eurozone system, so there's a strong expectation that the Irish pound was going to have to devalue, so it opened us up to speculative attack. So Irish interest rates skyrocketed to protect the currency, the value of the currency. But even if that hadn't have happened, the asymmetric shock would nevertheless have been very important. Sterling fell by around 10% in each case over a very short period of time. That would have been a huge competitiveness loss to Irish industry. Would the automatic fiscal stabilisers that remain in place, even under the new fiscal compact, would they have been sufficient to cope? And these were big competitiveness shocks. So my guess is probably not. So industry would have fallen, unemployment would have risen, right, because sterling fell, and had we maintained the value of our currency, that's a big competitiveness loss to us. So we would have had job losses, we would have gone into recession, budget deficits normally rise, of course, in a recession. That's what we mean by the automatic stabilizers. Even if we were running zero budget deficits at the time, or even slight surpluses, the automatic stabilizers would have caused the country automatically to go into deficit. Now, if we had hit the 3% deficit limit at that time, what would have happened? Well, what the new fiscal pact would entail is, even if we were running a zero deficit at the time and we got hit with a big asymmetric shock, the deficit would automatically rise. If it went over 3%, we'd be hit with punishing fines, right, under the new fiscal compact. That would impose clearly further austerity on top of the austerity, on top of the recession that had already been generated by the asymmetric shock. So I'm sure already you've eyeballed the final paragraph on this slide. So a study done by the European Commission itself analysed for the EU-12 economies, the 24 most severe recessionary episodes. Five of those 24 would have led to violation of the Stability and Growth Pact, in other words, the 3% deficit limit, even if countries had begun with deficits of zero. So in other words, major recessions in the past would have breached the Stability and Growth Pact limits of 3% and would have triggered the automatic fines that are now enshrined, or going to be enshrined even more strongly, in national legislation or in the Constitution, depending. So in other words, this will impose, if another shock like this occurs, right, that the limits, the fiscal limits would be breached, the fines would be imposed, austerity would be heaped upon austerity. In the German view, as it's called, and I'll let you read that, maybe that doesn't matter so much. The German view, and Trichet was not German, of course. In fact, in a speech to the central bank, he made play of the fact that he was actually a Breton, so he could relate, you know, to Irish conditions and so on, as a fellow Celt. But what's written here, this is what economists call the expansionary fiscal contraction hypothesis. It's an extremely anti-Keynesian view of the world. And it's also called the German view, even at the time when it was first proposed. In the early to mid-1990s, it was called the German view. They don't really believe in Keynesianism the way most of us do. Now, most of us Irish economists think Keynesian policies are not very appropriate for small open economies like Ireland, but they're appropriate for big economies like the Eurozone or the US or Britain. Clearly, in the German view, though, even if you're forced hit with fiscal fines because your budget is going over the limit, maybe that's not going to do too much damage to the economy, if you believe the German view. You'll have noticed in the last few weeks, though, that even the Germans are retreating from that view in the face of, you know, the onslaught from the IMF, saying, look, you have to think, you have to realise the Keynesian view of the world is of relevance. So even there's a retreat from that view. The doomsday asymmetric shock scenario for Ireland, I think very unlikely, but the doomsday would be, let's say, our multinational corporations pull out of Ireland because either of changes in US tax laws, which were, you know, proposed over the course of Barack Obama's race for the Democratic nomination, but I've been reading back on this. Even in the 1960s, Democratic politicians running for president of the US were threatening to change these laws, and they never get changed, so it's populist campaigning. Or if the common consolidated corporate tax base comes in, and if it wipes out our corporation tax base, that's a big asymmetric shock to our deficit. The deficit would expand, would hit the deficit limits, and we'd be hit with punishing fines. So again, austerity piled on austerity. So this is an absolute fetish about, you know, the all importance, the notion that fiscal responsibility can cure all problems of asymmetric shocks in the Eurozone. It is just completely incredible. So the question was asked when the Eurozone debate was taking place, well, how does the US fiscal system work? If the US is an optimal currency area, why not Europe? And people who began to take that question seriously realized the massive role played by the federal budget in the US. If a region like California is hit with a state-specific or an asymmetric shock, for every dollar decline in Californian income, relative to the rest of the US, the federal budget cushions that shock by up to 40 cents. That's a massive cushioning effect. Same for New England if it gets hit by an asymmetric shock. So the federal budget cushions it. Most of that cushioning takes place because the state will owe less taxes to the federal budget, and there's a smaller element whereby the federal budget reallocates expenditure towards that state. So that's the way the US fiscal federation works, to cushion asymmetric shocks. We have nothing like that in the Eurozone. It's not been talked about in the fiscal compact. But the logic is completely obvious that this is the way. If the euro survives 15 years from now, 20 years from now, we're going to have a massive federal budget, because the logic is completely unassailable. You know, this is the only logic by which the Eurozone can survive is, you know, movement towards a fiscal federation, and not the kind of fiscal union that's talked about, you know, with these small pots of money that are allegedly around for insurance purposes now and so on. Not the fiscal union that's talked about with respect to harmonization of corporation taxes and so on, which is not a significant issue because US states compete with each other in terms of corporation tax. Delaware is one of the lowest corporation tax states in the world, which is why so many US multinational corporations are headquartered in Delaware. So this talk of fiscal union is really beside the point. This fiscal federalism is, you know, is the way things are going to go, you know, if this logic is correct. As I say, I'm fairly sure it is. Paul de Grauwe, who is an excellent commentator, you know, the two guys, if they come on Morning Ireland at 7 o'clock and I'm still snoozing, I jump wide awake if they're on, are Eichen Green, who I talked about, and Paul de Grauwe. They're frequently enough on Morning Ireland, and, you know, their analysis is always really, really well worth listening to. Back in 1999, you know, he recognised this. A lot of people recognised this. Failure to create a European government with responsibilities like the US federal government creates a risk of the breakup of the monetary union. He was referring in this particular case to the fiscal federalism argument that I just outlined, but when I posted this on the Irish Economy several months ago, John Sheehan, a former colleague of mine from UCD, came back with an even more brilliant quote from de Grauwe around the same time, that he and Paul Krugman were also warning that the kind of much freer capital mobility that you would have in the Eurozone would reinforce regional booms. So in a complete capital mobility union as we have now, a regional boom that starts in Ireland or Spain sucks in huge amounts of capital from across the EU to the Eurozone to a much greater extent than would have occurred before. And this threatens the financial stability of the system unless regulatory structures were federalised. De Grauwe warned about this at the time. There's been no discussion, of course, over the course of, you know, the current fiscal compact that's been proposed about the importance that's surely obvious to every Irish person now that, you know, the failures that we've seen in Ireland and Spain had nothing to do with fiscal irresponsibility, or very little. They were caused by, you know, by other factors. And the banking problems that have arisen, there's no discussion about how these banking problems are to be rectified. But you know, as you know, many Irish economists over the last couple of years have been saying, you know, what we need is a common, in other words, a federalised fiscal regulatory system and a fiscal bank a bank regulatory and a bank resolution system. Now, a common or federalised banking regulatory system would not cure all problems. It clearly didn't function brilliantly in the US, which has a federalised regulatory system. Lots of, you know, banking problems emerged in the US, of course. So it's not at all the answer to everything. But there's a lot of reasons to think why, you know, one does need a federalised or, you know, a supranational banking regulatory system. Amongst them, and I'll just make this one point, though we can go into it further, you know, if people like, that the Honohan report into the operation of the central bank and so on, the regulatory structure and the contribution it made to the current crisis, pointed out that the Irish regulator was included as part of delegations selling the IFSC as a location around the world to foreign financial services firms. And what he was doing there, of course, was to reassure them that, you know, look, the regulation in Ireland will be very light touch. That's a conflict of interest. That's the sort of thing, you know, a pan-European regulator system would avoid. You get the same thing with the City of London. You know, the importance of financial services to the UK economy is so large that they, again, are forced into that same system of perverse incentives. So that's the sort of reason why you need a federalised or pan-European banking regulatory system. This is a quick quote, and I'm almost done, yeah, from what Paul de Grauwe wrote in 1998. He plucked Spain not quite out of thin air, because it was clear, you know, Spain and Ireland had experienced very high interest rates compared to German interest rates before the Eurozone, before the Euro came into existence. It was clear interest rates were going to come down in these two economies. That would lead to a regional boom, you know, as long as other preconditions were there. And regional booms are almost always associated with asset price booms or house price booms. And then he says, okay, Spanish asset prices explode. This is the hypothetical example. Lots of funds sucked in from all the Eurozone. After the boom comes the bust, asset prices collapse, creating a crisis in the Spanish banking system. You know, that's pretty prescient now for Paul de Grauwe writing back in the 1990s. US Monetary Union provides many such examples. And then, this is all from the same Financial Times article, you know, so it's quite remarkable that John Sheen, you know, came across it and drew it to my attention. Excessive debt accumulation by the private sector can be equally, if not more, risky. It's something that will be obvious to everybody now in Ireland, given the current crisis. The institutions that should guard monetary union from financial and banking crisis are still to be put in place, and that remains the case to this day. So we need that element of federalism as well. So, I've made this point already. Our own Dr. Doom, of course, refers to Morgan Kelly. This is one of the great quotes that I got from Morgan. The existing situation, you know, without a federalised banking regulatory and banking resolution system is like expecting the taxpayers of Newcastle to regulate and to bail out Northern Rock if and when it went bust. So I think that's a very telling statement. And then the final slide is this one that I'm not going to go into in any detail, but it will be obvious to people who've been watching the politics of what's been going on. Gareth Fitzgerald, in every column he wrote on European affairs, pointed to the invaluable role that the European Commission played as a defence of smaller states' interests. It's clear that the governance of the Eurozone is very different from the governance of the EU. And this is something, you know, that one wonders why Irish political scientists, for example, were not drawing attention to this. This is a situation that we find ourselves in now, and it's one that cannot be rectified in our favour. So, thanks.